today on Path of Grace.
Murmuring. What is it? Well, I think a great way to describe murmuring is to just say the word murmur, 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 murmur. Murmuring is what murmur sounds like. When I think about murmuring, I think about an old farm dog my dad had when I was a kid. The old dog's name was Bullet, and Bullet was a hound dog. Kind of a dog with a bad attitude at times. Everyone always said they thought he was kind of inbred or something. He did act a little bit weird. But he was overall a pretty good dog. Really a great farm dog. But he had some weird quirks. He liked to murmur a lot. For instance, every morning as my dad would walk out the door and head to his truck, he'd say to Bullet the hound dog, "Bullet, get in." And then it was Bullet's job to jump in the back of the truck to ride on out to the farm. And Bullet would get up obediently, and he'd start walking to the truck, and he'd jump in the truck. But with every step toward that truck, he would growl, a growl with every step that every foot took. So as he was walking toward the truck, doing what my dad had given him to do, he was just all the way. And it was actually kind of creepy because he's a scary looking dog. And if you didn't know that dog, it would have freaked you out. You probably wonder if he had rabies or something because it was just weird as he murmured and murmured and murmured. Now, here's the thing. The dog did exactly what my dad gave him to do. But there was just this ugly, mean dog attitude that permeated Bullet's murmuring action. I don't know about you, but whenever I think about Paul's letter to the Philippians, the first passage that generally comes to mind is in chapter 4. There's a few verses there. You probably know the ones I'm talking about, where Paul gives the prescription for dealing with anxiety, which I've got to confess, I don't always follow his prescription all that well. He says, "Be anxious for nothing, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God, and the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus." And then he says, and this is good stuff, "Finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there is any virtue, if there's anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things." Is that good stuff or what? But you got to admit, it's kind of challenging to always put it into practice, right? This is the kind of verses that we need to look at daily, to be reminded of daily, maybe write them out on a piece of paper and tape them to the bathroom mirror so that you see them first thing in the morning and right before you go to bed and maybe even once or twice in the middle of the night. See, rather than worrying about all the what-ifs regarding the future and spending time on the regrets about the past, rather than running conversations of yesterday round and round in your mind and wondering how you could have done it different, rather than playing out possible scenarios of conversations and interaction tomorrow over and over again in your head, Paul's telling us that really, if we have time to think about those things, we have time to pray about those things, and rather than sitting there worrying and being all anxious about it, talk to Father about it. Now, as Paul is writing these words, remember, he's writing from prison. And he's reminding us that regardless of where we are or what our present circumstance is, we always have something to be thankful for, right? And that as we take time to express that gratitude, that thankfulness, and as we take time to pray, he's letting us know that something will take place inside of our hearts. As we give thanks to Father for the blessings we have, the blessings that we find in our present circumstances, and the blessings we know that will one day come. Paul in these verses is reminding us that rather than focusing on the negative and focusing on the ugly and the negative in ourselves and in others, to instead look for and focus on and find something good, something lovely, something praiseworthy. Now, I got to admit, it's probably a challenge for some people to look at me and find anything good, lovely, and praiseworthy. And I've also got to admit, when I look at some other people, it's hard for me to find some good, lovely, and praiseworthy things. But man, oh man, imagine for a moment what it might do in our hearts if we, throughout each day, as we interacted with other people, made it our focus to look for the good, to look for the lovely, to look for those positive attributes, and maybe to tell the person what we see and to celebrate that, because so many people, all they hear about is the negative or what's wrong with them. How much would we be able to build one another up if we focused on those things that are good, those things that are praiseworthy? It's sad how these simple and beautiful words that I just read to you from Paul are the exact opposite of what we're prone to do. And I'm talking about myself. And you probably noticed it in yourself as well. And just thinking about those words in Philippians 4, I think after I wrap up recording this audio, I need to spend a few extra minutes just sitting here quietly, thinking on, looking for those beautiful things, those praiseworthy things, and giving God thanks, because this is a prescription that Paul gives us. And when we put it into practice, it makes a difference in so many ways. And I think Paul shared it here in Philippians chapter 4 because he knew it would be helpful for us when it comes to some of the things he shares in chapter 2, which is where we currently find ourselves in the study through Philippians. Now, you remember, in our last study, which was entitled Grace Works, not only did we look at Philippians chapter 2, we also took a little trip over to Ephesians chapter 2, where Paul talks about salvation not being based upon our works, but upon grace. Yet, he went on in Ephesians chapter 2, verse 10. Remember what he said? He told us that we are God's workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepares beforehand that we should walk in them. And in Philippians chapter 2, you remember from last time, Paul told us that God is working in you both to will and to work for his good pleasure. God is at work within you and me, stirring up works for us to do. Now, if you missed that audio, you ought to give it a listen. And I wanted to mention all of those things because it's important, because it connects with what we come to next in chapter 2 in verse 14, where Paul says, "All things do without murmurings and reasonings." Some translations word it a little bit differently. They say, "Do all things without murmuring and complaining." But Young's literal translation and the Concordant Literal New Testament use the words murmurings and reasonings. God's given us work to do. He has works for us to do that he's prepared in advance for us each and every day. And now Paul says, as he writes from prison, do all these things without murmuring and reasoning. Murmuring. What is it? Well, I think a great way to describe murmuring is to just say the word murmur, 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 murmur. Murmuring is what murmur sounds like. When I think about murmuring, I think about an old farm dog my dad had when I was a kid. The old dog's name was Bullet, and Bullet was a hound dog. Kind of a dog with a bad attitude at times. Everyone always said they thought he was kind of inbred or something. He did act a little bit weird. But he was overall a pretty good dog, really a great farm dog. But he had some weird quirks. He liked to murmur a lot. For instance, every morning as my dad would walk out the door and head to his truck, he'd say to Bullet, the hound dog, "Bullet, get in." And then it was Bullet's job to jump in the back of the truck to ride on out to the farm. And Bullet would get up obediently and he'd start walking to the truck and he'd jump in the truck. But with every step toward that truck, he would growl, a growl with every step that every foot took. So as he was walking toward the truck, doing what my dad had given him to do, he was just all the way. And it was actually kind of creepy because he was a scary looking dog. And if you didn't know that dog, it would have freaked you out. You probably wonder if he had rabies or something, because it was just weird as he murmured and murmured and murmured. Now, here's the thing. The dog did exactly what my dad gave him to do. But there was just this ugly, mean dog attitude that permeated Bullet's murmuring actions. My friend, Paul tells us in Ephesians chapter 1 that God is working all things according to his will. In other words, there's a rhyme and a reason for all that goes on in the world. Even when it comes to you being a believer right here, right now, there's a reason for it. And as Father puts you wherever he puts you, whenever he puts you there, and as he puts me wherever he puts me, whenever he puts me there, and he gives you things to do where you're at and gives me things to do where I'm at, those works that he's prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. The truth is, from the human perspective, there's going to be a lot of it that might not make any sense at all. Even when we attempt to reason through them the best we possibly can, it might not make a whole lot of sense. And we might want to complain and murmur about what God has given us to do. You know, Jesus, as he was walking on this earth, speaking to his fellow Jews who were living under Roman oppression, there was a lot that he said that made no sense. And the people didn't simply murmur about it. They just flat out ignored it. He said things like, love your enemies and bless those who persecute you. Do good to those who spitefully use you. Now, goodness, think about those poor Jews who had seen and experienced the rotten things the Romans were doing to them. They probably couldn't reason through why they should love those Romans and bless those Romans and do good to those Romans who were using and abusing and harming and harassing them. Their emotions wouldn't have allowed them to reason through it to the point of actually doing it. Jesus' message, his prescription, was so unpopular that he was flat out rejected, and still he pretty much is. But as we look at it from where we're at, living here in what year is this, 2014, I can't help but wonder, what if all of Israel had been able to have their ears opened and heard what Jesus said and been able to really reason through it? I wonder if they would have concluded, and I wonder if the purpose for that teaching might have been for them to destroy their enemies by making them their friends. Get what I'm saying? Anyway, Paul says, do all things without murmuring and reasoning. When I think about murmuring against what you've been given to do and trying to reason through it, but it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You know, you may have played sports when you were a kid, and you may have experienced, especially as a young athlete in junior high or high school, being told to do certain things that at the time didn't make any sense at all. I remember going to football practice, and the first couple of weeks of practice were shocking, especially your first year, because it seemed like all you did was run, 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 and then run some more. Sometimes we ran until we literally vomited. And I remember thinking, I thought I was supposed to be playing football. I didn't sign up for track. I wanted to play football. When are we going to learn some plays? When are we going to do all this other stuff? There are probably moments where I may have thought the coach hated my guts and was trying to torture me. The rest of the team may have thought the same thing. But then, you know what? Later on, you began to realize how important all that running was, as painful as it was. That conditioning was important. That without going through those difficult, painful times of running during practice, doing all those drills that at times seemed to make no sense because they didn't even involve a football, all of that was actually laying an important foundation that would enable you to have the strength and endurance to actually do the job, which was to come later on the football field. Eventually, you realized that even if you could quote all the plays in the playbook and had them all memorized, without going through that time of preparation that was very, very painful, man, it wouldn't matter how much of that book you had memorized. When the time to play would come, you'd get beat to a pulp. You'd be out of the game. Now, it's probably a weak illustration, because God is more than a coach, and this universe is more than a football field. God is our loving Father. Now, something I'm convinced of is that what we presently see in the world is not all that there is going to be. The condition of humanity, the condition of this universe in its present state, is not what always will be. This age will come to an end. There will come a time when Father reveals to us all that he has prepared for us to do. When, in a sense, we step out of practice and onto the field, when game time really gets here. See, for much of my life, I had been taught that the ultimate destiny for believers is that we would end up in heaven where forever and ever and ever, endlessly, eternally, here's what we are to do. We are to be on our faces in adoration, singing songs of praise to God, saying, holy, holy, holy. That's what we're supposed to do. Forever and ever and ever, we're going to be in the throne room of God, laying prostrate upon our faces. Is that what you're expecting? Is that what you're looking for? Is that what's going to be? Are you sure about that? I'd been led to believe that God created us and is having us go through all we're going through in this present age for no other reason than for us to simply go to heaven to lay on our faces forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. Now, let me ask you, honestly, does that sound all that exciting? Now, I know it would be mind-blowing, and it will be mind-blowing when we see God. Oh, my goodness. When we meet Jesus, oh, my goodness, we probably will fall on our faces. But do you think God's desire, God's hope in creation was to simply have millions of people to lay on their faces, or billions of people to lay on their faces, or trillions of people to lay on their faces forever? A lot of religious people would say yes, because it beats the alternative of being tortured by God forever and ever. And if you have a choice between being tortured in hell or simply laying on your face in heaven forever and ever, I'll take laying on my face. That's the good news. We get to lay on our faces in heaven forever and ever. But let me share with you an example of just a couple of verses that I think clue us in that God, our creator, God, the master designer of the universe, has bigger plans in store for us. And he didn't create us just so we could have a bunch of people to lay on their faces forever and ever and ever. It seems to me that God, our creator, who created man in his image, has much more in store for us. That creative being created beings with creativity. And I think he's going to want us to put that into practice. Let me share with you a verse that I think does a little more than simply hint to the fact that God has more in store for us than just laying on our faces in heaven forever and ever. Now, I got to tell you, I don't understand all that is contained in these verses, all that is implied in these verses, all the fullness of what is being said in these verses. But one thing I know for sure is in these verses, Paul is painting a picture of something God has in store for us that is way beyond what the religious world ever gives God credit for. It's Romans chapter 8, verses 16, 17, and 18. I want to read it first of all from the Concordant Literal New Testament. Here we go. The Spirit itself is testifying together with our spirit that we are children of God. Yet if children, enjoyers also of an allotment, enjoyers indeed of an allotment from God, yet joint enjoyers of Christ's allotment. If so be that we are suffering together, that we should be glorified together also. Did you hear that? Paul tells us that as children of God, we are enjoyers of an allotment. There is something that God has allotted to us that is going to be enjoyable. He says we are enjoyers indeed of an allotment from God. And then he said we are enjoyers of Christ's allotment. Then he talks about us suffering now, but being glorified together also. Think about Christ. He suffered on this earth. But is that how things wrapped up with Jesus? No, he was glorified. Now, let some of what we just read sink in. We are enjoyers of Christ's allotment. Now, let me ask you, do you think Christ's allotment, his inheritance, what Father has in store for him is to spend all of eternity laying on his face? Or do you think Father has something more exciting and creative and wonderful and beautiful for Jesus to be doing? Here's those same verses from Young's literal translation. The Spirit himself doth testify with our spirit that we are children of God, and if children, also heirs. Think about it. A child is an heir of what his father has, right? And he says, if you are children of God, you are also heirs, heirs indeed of God, heirs together of Christ. If indeed we suffer together, that we also may be glorified together. He's letting us know that as we suffer in this age we're living in, to be encouraged, because this isn't all there is. We are heirs together with Christ. And then in verse 18, for I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory about to be revealed in us. We are heirs. We will receive an allotment. The suffering we face in this life is somehow, for lack of a better way to put it, a preparation for what is to come. In the midst of the suffering, we are called to love, care for, and serve one another. It's hard. It's challenging. At times we may want to grumble, 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 but we got to realize it's all serving a purpose that at this point we might not understand. We might not be able to figure out. We might not be able to reason through it. Now, I look at these verses. I don't know what all it means to be an heir of God, but think about your own kids if you have any. Did you have kids so that eventually they could come to see you as being as wonderful as you are so that they could just lay on their faces at your feet? Or did you have kids with the hope and desire of sharing something special and beautiful and wonderful with them and seeing them grow up into all that you hope they would be? Do you think that desire you have for your kids, that this creative process is something placed in you by God? Do you think your desire for your kids is greater than God's desire for his? No way. Here's those same verses from another translation. The Spirit himself testifies with our spirit that we are children of God, and if children, heirs also, heirs of God and fellow heirs with Christ, if indeed we suffer with him so that we may also be glorified with him. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed in us. Man, oh man. Again, I don't know what all this means. I wish I did. All I know is Paul is writing to these saints, and he's saying, guys, gals, I want to remind you of something. You are children of God. And if you're a child, you are an heir. If you're a child of God, you are an heir of God, which means you are a fellow heir with Christ, who the Bible calls a son of God. Now think about the wording of this again. An heir of God, an heir with Christ. Is that saying that whatever it is that Father has given Christ is also given to us? Well, think about this terminology. If a man has three sons and they are all heirs, doesn't that mean they're going to share whatever it is their father has given them? Yeah, here's those words again. The Spirit himself testifies with our spirit that we are children of God, and if children, heirs also, heirs of God and fellow heirs with Christ, if indeed we suffer with him so that we may also be glorified with him. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed in us. My friend, we are heirs with Christ. There is an allotment. There is an inheritance. And the suffering of this present time is not worthy of comparing to the glory that is to be revealed. This is to encourage us. That's why Paul's sharing these words. Now you may ask, why the suffering? Why the hardship? Why did God create things the way he created them? Well, we grappled with those questions last summer in a series of audios called The Problem of Evil. And you should be able to find them on the main page of my website or in the audio archive. I believe it all has something to do with contrast. And that's all I'm going to say about that for now, because I want to try to get the rest of the way through Philippians chapter 2. And I want you to understand that the big point, what I'm wanting us to get our minds wrapped around, is that what we see isn't all there is. What we are experiencing isn't all there is. God is at work, and what he's doing in our lives right now, which is sometimes painful, is to prepare us for what is to come. And it is much more than laying on our faces forever in a throne room in the heavenlies. God is going to have amazing, fulfilling, satisfying, stimulating, creativity-filled things for us to do because we are heirs with Christ. And you know what else? I believe when we begin to discover our identity and our calling, even here and now, we begin to get a taste of those fulfilling, satisfying, stimulating, creativity-filled things that Father has for us to do. We get a taste of what is to come, even if we don't really understand it and we can't reason all the way through it. But you need to keep these things in mind as you walk through life. And it will make it much easier to do all things without murmuring. Again, even if you can't figure out exactly why God has you doing what you're doing, where you're doing it, right at this moment. Now, we started off by looking at some words in chapter 4 where he's telling us to think about these particular type of things. And I encourage you, think about these things because it's good stuff. It's beautiful. So now in verse 14, again, he says, all things do without murmurings and reasonings, that ye may become blameless and harmless children of God, or recognized by the world around you as children of God, unblemished in the midst of a generation crooked and perverse, among whom ye do appear as luminaries in the world. A luminary is a light. It's a lamp. My friend, as we do what Father has given us without murmuring, as we put into practice the things Paul talked about earlier in this chapter. Remember, he talked about loving and caring for the people around us, not simply looking out for our own interests, but also for the interests of others. In other words, loving our neighbor as ourselves. When we do that, we're going to be recognized as children of God. The world will look at us and say, whoa. Remember, Jesus told the disciples, the world will know that you are my disciples by the love you have for one another. And as Paul is really talking about the same thing, as we live out this love life, doing what God has given us to do, we will be recognized as children of God. We will shine like light. We're going to stick out like a sore thumb. Verse 16, the word of life holding forth, for rejoicing to me in regard to a day of Christ, that not in vain did I run, nor in vain did I labor. In other words, he's talking about wanting to see these guys and gals putting these things into practice so he will know that what he's been talking to them about, what he's been living out in front of them, has made a difference. Verse 17, but if also I am poured forth upon the sacrifice and service of your faith, I rejoice and joy with you all. Paul knew that his life could be taken from him at any point in that prison, and I believe that's what he's talking about when he talks about being poured forth a sacrifice. Verse 18, because of this, do ye also rejoice and joy with me. And I hope in the Lord Jesus, Timothy, to send quickly to you, that I also may be of good spirit, having known the things concerning you. For I have no one like-minded who sincerely for the things concerning you will care. Poor Paul, he goes, you know what? I've been trying to find more people who have the same care for you that I do, but they're kind of hard to find. As Paul talks about not having people like-minded, when you read his last letter we have in the scriptures, 2 Timothy, he talks about not only did he not have anyone like-minded as he approached the end of his life and ministry, but he said all had forsaken him, all had abandoned him. In other words, before Paul's life had ended, most of those he had ministered to had already turned from the gospel of grace and gone into something else, a gospel which is no gospel at all. Verse 21, for the whole seek their own things, not the things of the Christ Jesus. Paul talked again earlier in chapter 2 about not simply looking out for our own interests, but also for the interests of others. We should be seeking ways to bring value and enrichment into other people's lives. That's a very Jesus-y thing to do, and it's where we're going to find our satisfaction. Verse 22, and the proof of him ye know, that as a child serveth a father, with me he did serve in regard to the good news. Him indeed, therefore, I hope to send, when I may see through the things concerning me immediately. And I trust in the Lord that I myself also shall quickly come. Paul hoped to be able to visit them in the same way. Man, don't you just long to be in fellowship with brothers and sisters, people who are at least a little bit like-minded because of the encouragement and the edification that you can get from it? Maybe we need to do a Path of Grace retreat sometime. Wouldn't that be fun? I mean, there's so many people who I get emails from and who encourage me that, man, I would just love to be able to see them face to face, have a cup of coffee, pull out a guitar, sing some songs of praise, and stay up all night bragging about Jesus for 2 or 3 or 4 days. Wouldn't that be fun? Pray about it. Maybe someday we can do it. Verse 25, and I thought it necessary, Epaphroditus, my brother and fellow workman and fellow soldier, and your apostle and servant to my need, to send unto you, seeing he was longing after you all, and in heaviness, because ye heard that he ailed. For he also ailed nigh to death, but God did deal kindly with him, and not with him only, but also with me, that sorrow upon sorrow I might not have. Now, Epaphroditus had been working alongside of Paul. He had been sent there to help take care of Paul, and Paul is wanting to send him back to these folks in Philippi because he heard that they were kind of stressed out because Epaphroditus had been very, very what? Sick. Yeah, he had been ailing, and he almost died. This is yet another one of those passages where Paul lets us know that believers get sick. Having an ailment is not due to a lack of faith. Even in those things, is working all things according to the counsel of his will, and according to Romans 8:28, working all things together for the good. It's all for the good, ultimately. Everything we go through serves a purpose as God prepares us for what is to be. Right? Football practice. That's where we're at right now. And maybe, my friend, what is to be will be sooner than we think. Wouldn't that be nice? Verse 28. The more eagerly, therefore, I did send him. that having seen him again, ye may rejoice, and I may be the less sorrowful. Receive him, therefore, in the Lord with all joy, and hold such in honor, because on account of the work of the Christ, he drew near to death, having hazarded the life that he might fill up your deficiency of service unto me. Paul says he almost died serving the Lord. He was out here taking care of me and almost died. So please receive him and the Lord with joy and honor. And that's where we're going to wrap up today. We made it through all the way to the end of chapter 2. Sorry I kind of rushed through that last part, but I think you kind of got the point of it. My name is James Flanders. Thank you so much for listening. I got to tell you, man, I can't wait to see what it will mean for you and me to be heirs with Christ, enjoying the allotment. Maybe we'll talk more about that in the future, because it's exciting stuff, don't you think? Be blessed, my friend. Be blessed.